Great. So last week I started with a little bit about statistics, a review of statistics. What I can do is maybe run. Oops. P duplicate. That will do it. Okay. Here we are. Statistical decision making, uncertainty. If you remember, we talked about the general stuff like scientific inquiry and uncertainty around us, that everything around us is uncertain. Then I showed you a simple data set telling that it's not unusual to have a lot of uncertainty, noise in the data, something that computer scientists may feel tempted to call exceptions. And then we talked about this imaginary example of an experiment where we test whether sexual intercourse is related to pregnancy. I talked a little about sampling, inference from sample to population. And the results of an experiment like this will look as follows. And then the surprising thing that the results look not at the first sight, they don't look terribly conclusive because you see that there are pregnancies in the control group and there are no pregnancies in the treatment group. So, and not everybody lasted until the end of the experiment. So the question is, what do we do now? Everybody's expecting from us a decision here, a scientist, so we need to make a decision. And what do we do? We have to resort to statistics when we don't know what to do. Statistical inference is not about not always about single occurrences, but about patterns. And then sources of uncertainty. We discussed this, why there is so much noise in this the case of this imaginary experiment. We need to make a decision, essentially. Now, again, features of scientific inquiry. And then we went into the brief review of probability theory and statistics. Another quote, perhaps you could turn off one of the lights so that it's a little bit darker. Maybe the other one. We can even turn both off because that gives us enough light to feel comfortable here. Quote from Laplace, talking about common sense plus calculation in case of probabilities. I told you that statistics is the branch of mathematics that we should definitely use when we are dealing with noise. I gave a long story about the Dutch book argument. And I think this was the last slide last week. I showed you just as a collection of data, a data set. And we'll talk about different statistical tools in the context of this data set. Statistics is essentially probability theory applied to data. So that's why in statistics we always deal with data. In this case, this is a real data set. We have 8 different variables and then 170 records, I think. Every record is a case of a university measured over each of these 8 variables simultaneously. The first set of tools that statistics will give us in looking at data are measures of central tendency. So where the action is, where there are most data, and then measures of spread. Central tendency are things like mean, mode, median, trimmed mean. Mode is the value occurring with the greatest frequency. Median is, you can imagine, the distribution and then kind of the middle part of it where there's just as many on the left as there are on the right. A mean is the arithmetic average. Trimmed mean is when you start throwing away the extreme values that are really far from the middle. Measures of spread tell you how much noise there is, how much the values are spread. And the typical measure of spread that you probably know is variance, standard deviation. These are the two. One is square root of the other. But there are other things like range, extended range, etc. There's also average deviation. These are just different measures of expressing how spread the values are. Every statistical package will give you those basic statistics. Here on this slide, you can see. On this slide, you can see the output of Excel. You can ask Excel if you have a data set open to give you the basic statistics. There are more than just the measures of spread and measure of concentration. There are also other, they call it moments, there are formulas for them, and they express things like asymmetry, for example, in the distribution, skewness. Kurtosis, I don't really remember what the common sense meaning of that moment is. These are, I think, moments of the distribution. Mean is the first moment, variance is the second moment, and kurtosis third, skewness is, I think, the fourth moment. On the bottom, you see things coming from Program Gini, which we will use starting even today. Distributions, I'm just giving a very quick review of important tools from statistics. Distributions are essentially telling us information about where the values are, how spread they are. We can see it pictorially. This is just taken from a web page, an example of a normal distribution or Gaussian. These are synonyms, normal and Gaussian. For example, grade distribution in a university course. If this is 0, this is 100, you can see what percentage of students were in which range of values. I think I pressed on something that I shouldn't have pressed on the picture. Oh, that has cannot. Okay, that's very good. I don't want to get it. Oh, that's just a cartoon. You can look at it later. Histograms are the next tool in statistics that is very useful. When you have a data set, you can you have a single variable. This is one of the variables of that data set, test scores. And what you do is you divide the range into buckets, into small intervals of equal size, and you count how many values there are in every of the intervals. And that's, you show that by the bars. So you see where the action is, where the values are mostly located. For example, you see that there are many values between 60 and 62, let's say. This is the most popular bucket, the most popular set of values. It's important to remember that histograms look differently depending on the size of those bins, buckets or bins. This is the same data set, the same variable, shown when there are just 10 buckets, and this is, I don't know how many, let's say 100 buckets. You see that they look differently. It's a good idea to look at the same data, the same histogram, changing the size of the buckets. Why would you want to do that? You can do that in order to find out what distribution you are dealing with, how the data are distributed. The same idea, two different sets of bins, buckets, and the same data. This is uniform distribution. So the data, every value is equally likely in the range of between 0 and 1. Distributions are used for convenience. There are many of them. I have a picture on one of the next slides of different distributions. Some distributions are very common. For example, normal distribution, also called Gaussian. We know why it's so common. There's an explanation for that. In a theorem in statistics known as central limit theorem, when you have a sum of variables, then the sum is distributed normally under very weak assumptions. Initial version of the theorem was that you needed infinitely many elements in the sum. They had to be independent. The very, very first version was that they have to be normally distributed. But today, central limit theorem is known to be very, very robust. And as long as the distributions of individual components are not too weird, the sum is going to be distributed normally. Very, very strong theorem. And it's a very popular distribution in the world. For example, IQ is distributed normally. Why is it distributed normally? IQ tests give you many questions, for example, 100 questions to answer. And you can look at every question as a random variable. Do you know the answer or you don't know the answer? And then the answer to every one of the questions, a random variable, the total score is the sum of scores of individual questions. The sum is going to be distributed normally. So it's a very, very, if you look at the IQ results of many people, you see that it's really a beautiful normal distribution. Heights of people are normally distributed. You can view height of any person as, the person grew every year or every month a little bit. How much did they grow? Well, it depends on how well they ate, were they sick that year, that month, or exactly how they were developing. So if it's a sum, it's distributed normally, so the heights of people. Plants also. Here's a picture with many distributions. We have here 16 different distributions. Typically, distributions have physical reasons for occurring. I explain you the normal. There's a sum of things. Log normal occurs when you have a product of things. Apparently, the wind speeds are distributed log normally because winds are enhancing one another. You are dealing with a multiplicative process, and the distribution of wind speeds is known to be log normal. And for every distribution, there is typically a reason for why the distribution looks like this. So first of all, they imitate, the distributions actually not imitate, they occur naturally, but also it's very convenient to use them because you can use them, you can describe the data using just one, two, or three parameters, very, very simply. The next important tool in statistics are scatter plots. Scatter plots are drawn very easily. When you have two variables, they are most useful in case of two variables. You have one variable, in this case it's upred, and the test scores, and every record in our data set corresponds to a point. So this point, for example, corresponds to a record in which test scores was 74 and upred was 55. Every point corresponds to a pair of values. In three dimensions, you can do that in three dimensions, so three variables at the same time. But with four and more, of course, it's very difficult because it's difficult to present a space that has more than three dimensions. On a paper, two dimensions is the max. But if you have a computer screen, you can actually, with some rotations, you can show three variables. But four variables is going to be difficult. So they are useful. Why are they useful? Well, they show you dependence between variables. For example, in this case, you see that the two variables are dependent. When this variable takes high values in this range, look at that, then the other variable takes also high values. And you can see that the dependence, this is an attempt to fit a line to that to these data points, but it's not really a line, as you see. I can see a curvature. So there's a function that goes like this between the two variables, and it may be quadratic, maybe polynomial, we don't know that. But you see dependence between them. That's important. Correlation is a measure of linear dependence. So when the dependence is linear, like let's say in this case, we see it's more like a line with a lot of noise. This could be approximated by a line. Then you can express the dependence by means of a correlation. It's a measure that produces one number between minus 1 and 1 and tells you about correlation. 0 means that the variables are not correlated. Positive value is they are positively correlated. Negative value, negatively correlated. Negatively means when one increases, the other one is decreasing. There's an interesting history with correlation. The guy who produced it, Francis Galton, in 19th century, he was so enthusiastic about this that he said, this is replacing the concept of causation. The first mathematicians who created probability theory used the word cause a lot. They talked about causal relationships. When Galton proposed correlation, he tried to erase the word cause from the language. We don't need cause, we can have correlation. That had a very negative impact on the history of statistics. And until probably 1990s, very few textbooks of statistics used the word cause. People didn't understand what cause exactly meant and essentially did not use the word. It was a dirty word. Correlation sometimes makes sense, but sometimes it's tricky. Correlation between smoking and lung cancer makes sense. We understand that smoking may be a causal factor in lung cancer. But, for example, ice cream consumption and drowning, very strong correlation. The more ice cream consumed, the more people are drowning. It may not make sense initially as a correlation. When you think about the causal structure here, it is slightly different. And we will talk about this in a little bit. If you calculate correlation for a pair of variables, when you have a data set, you can calculate correlation between every pair of variables in a data set. That gives us a matrix with 1 on diagonal, because every variable is perfectly correlated with itself. So the correlation is 1. Off the diagonal, correlations are somewhere between minus 1 and 1, and the matrix is symmetric. So the same values are in the upper part of the matrix. So this matrix is triangular, expresses correlation between every single pair of variables. And we can see that. In this case, this is a picture from Gini showing with a bar the size of the correlation so that you can right away see where the correlations are strong when they are where they are weak. Correlation does not mean causation. That's a very popular statement in statistic textbooks before causation became again interesting to statisticians, which is 21st century. Linear regression is an interesting procedure that tries to fit a line to a set of data points in a scatter plot. It's a regression line. The interesting thing is, if you look at this data set, this is a data set that I collected myself. It's a real data set. I was once teaching a statistics course to undergraduate students in US, and I asked them to, one by one, to come to the whiteboard and write down on a piece of paper, on a page that I prepared for them, the length and the height of the board. The difficulty that I gave them, and it was an estimate, they couldn't measure it, but they could estimate it. I asked them to do it in centimeters. And they are not used to it, because they use normally inches, feet, and yards. So you see that there's a big big spread of the values. One student estimated the length to be 150 centimeters. Another student went as far as 350 centimeters. You would not make mistakes like this, but it was a difficult task for them, so they made this mistake. And then another thing that I wanted to point out to you is that students who estimated the length to be small also estimated the height to be small. It was also expected. So probably a lot of the noise is because of the confusion with the measure, centimeters. In any case, when we have something like this, you would expect this to be in a linear relationship. You know, they give a big high length, they will also give high height. So we can try to fit a line to that equation. You can imagine me drawing a line, trying different lines that fit this cloud the best. But mathematicians, statisticians like a unique procedure that gives us just one line fitted to the data. So they want one procedure to do that, so that there's a unique line. They invented a procedure known as least square regression. By the way, the word regression in statistics means fitting a curve, a function, to points. Linear regression means fitting a line to data points. But you can also have nonlinear regression, kind of quadratic regression, polynomial, or whatever. Why do we do regression? Because we summarize the relationship between the two variables by a line with just two parameters, slope and displacement. Once we have a line, we can easily answer the question like, what would the student give for a height if that student gave the length of 200 centimeters? You just go to that line and the line tells you the value. The problem is that, as I said, the mathematicians would like to have one method for that gives us unique line. And that least squares regression works in the following way. You draw a line between every point and the line, and then you can imagine that as wiggling the line, moving the line in such a way that the sum of squares of distances that you have drawn is the smallest. Why squares and not just distances, absolute value of distances, I don't know. Probably it's very convenient in the formula, in the proof of the theorem. There's a proof that there's only one unique line if you follow that procedure. There's going to be just one line minimizing the squares of distances. The funny thing is about the least square regression, linear regression, is that it depends on in which direction you do it. If you regress height on length, this is what you will get. If you regress length on height, you get something different, because you are minimizing the distances of squares, sum of squares of distances, in this direction. And you get practically two lines, which is surprising, because if you derive one equation of a line, you can transform that equation and solve it for x from y, yes? And the funny thing is that you will not get the same line as running a regression in a different direction. That's funny. I think that's a flaw of that procedure. It's probably a convenient procedure to do, but it gives us this non-unique result, which I think is confusing. It's a flaw of the procedure. You can run regression in two-dimensional space, like here, one variable on another, but you can also do it in higher dimensions, for example, in three-dimensional space, so two variables, equation that gives us the third variable. In this case, we are dealing with a plane in three dimensions. The measure at the end, R squared adjusted, is essentially a transformed result of the sum of squares. It's the higher it is, the better, the more variance you explain in the data using the line, regression line. 50%, 62% is actually quite high. If you try to do linear regression to a cloud of points that are completely independent of one another, you will get R squared to be essentially zero. Yes, explains very, very little variance in the data. We will not talk much about this, but you can also analyze time series. Time series is a wise name for data that are indexed by time. The x-axis is time, and you see how the data are changing. You can do this, for example, in case of price of gold. Let me show you how it looks like. I should have price of gold somewhere in my browser. These are time series. Price of gold and silver over the last 30, 50 something years, right? We are experiencing a very high value of gold and silver at the moment. Probably the unrest about in the world. We had spikes like this, although lower, and permanent increase in value, which could express essentially inflation. We will not talk much about time series in this course. Just a little, but not much. In one case, one of the designs. Outliers is another statistical concept. When you have a data set, some points may be outliers. What are the outliers? Well, errors in typing the number into the data set, errors in measurement, but also individuals that don't fit in the population. In this case, these are data for US universities. There may be universities that are very unique. One example, Caltech. Very unique in the sense that it's a very young university, only a little bit over 100 years old. Very, very good, has the highest number of Nobel Prize winners among the faculty. Has a lot of money, very good faculty. It's just very, very different from the population of all universities. How do you identify outliers? Well, I is a very good tool. You can see that this point is far from where the action is. You can delete these points, maybe this one. There are also formal procedures for doing this, but human eye is very, very good also. The next thing is, so this was statistics, the important tools of statistics. Not all of them, but important. We'll still come back to the idea of making decisions. But if you remember, the example was with this imaginary experiment with intercourse and pregnancy. The question is, what should we do? What kind of decision should we make? Should we accept the hypothesis that intercourse causes pregnancy or not? Should we reject it or accept it? So we now are getting into this idea, the field of how do we make decisions, and statistics helps us. In decision theory, which is somewhere at the interaction of statistics, economics, game theory, operations research, in decision theory focuses on how we should make decisions. Sometimes decisions are easy. It's better to be healthy and rich than to be sick and poor, right? That's an easy choice. But sometimes the decisions, very often, most of the time actually, the decisions are difficult, because each one of you, each one of us, makes choices that where health and money are in conflict with one another. We work very hard in order to gain a position on the job market. We often sacrifice a little bit of our health. We sleep less, or we work harder, we relax less. So sometimes the decisions are difficult. In decision theory, we focus on maximizing utility, which is a measure of preferences, and we use probability to measure uncertainty. And we pick the choices that give us the highest expected utility, expected over probability. There is, before decision theory was created, which was early 20th century, there's an important piece of writing by Blaise Pascal in, I think it was 17th century, if I'm not mistaken. Pascal was a very interesting fellow. You probably know his name from physics, from combinatorics. Physics, a measure of pressure, Pascal. Combinatorics, Pascal's triangle, some contributions to combinatorics. I'm not sure if probability theory too, but just combinatorics. When he was young, he was a brilliant child, very bright. At the age of 5 or 6, he gained the attention of mathematicians in Paris because of his work in geometry. They found him brilliant. He was discussing things with them. The father has forbidden him to deal with geometry because he was concerned about his kind of health and development as a child. But when he became famous among the mathematicians in Paris, the father allowed him to do it. So he was brilliant. He did interesting things in life. But at the age of, I forgot how old, 16 or 18, he suffered a conversion. He converted from being a reckless young man running after women to become very, very religious. He became very religious. At that time, he gave up all the work in mathematics, in physics, in all the other things, and focused completely on religion, on God and belief. From that period, there are two writings. One set of writings that was published as a book is known as Letters from the Province. At that time, there was a powerful schism going on in the Catholic Church in France. Schism is essentially a different set of ideas that the mainstream considers incompatible with the teachings of the Church. He was responding to that schism in terms of letters from the province sent to journals in newspapers in Paris, and he pretty much destroyed that schism with his arguments. Everybody knew that it was a brilliant mind, but they didn't know it was Pascal. So that was one. The second book that he published was a set of thoughts published as pensées, reflections, thoughts. And one of the small chapters in that book is focusing on the question, should we believe in God or not? Why am I telling about this? It's because it really shows us decisions that we are facing, and you could view it as a precursor of decision theory. Very easy to understand what decision theory is about. He didn't draw a table like this. He didn't draw any pictures in this chapter. But essentially, he posed the question, should we believe in God or not? And he said, there are two variables that we are dealing with here. One variable is God exists or doesn't exist. So we don't know it. As you know, we haven't solved that problem so far. It's a difficult question. We don't know the answer to it. And then he said, well, there is our action. What can we do? We can believe and act as if believe. or we can doubt, or that's a synonym of not belief. You just doubt it. You don't know. You refuse to treat it seriously. And then, if you believe, and God exists, of course, the Christian doctrine was that you go to heaven forever, for eternity, you are saved. If you believe and God doesn't exist, well, you have suffered some losses. You didn't gamble, you didn't drink, smoke, didn't run after women or men, you know, whatever a sinful person is doing to have fun, you just forgo it. And if you doubt, on the other hand, and God exists, you are damned forever. You go to hell. That's really bad. Forever. And if God doesn't exist, well, you enjoyed some of those sinful fun things that a person can enjoy when unbound by any moral rules. Then this is similar to a tool in decision theory. This is actually a tool in decision theory. It's a tree where squares denote choices, variable that you have under your control. You can control whether you believe or doubt. And then we have an uncertain variable. We don't know which state we are dealing with. The only thing we can do is we can put probability distribution over that variable. And then these are the consequences. So what happens when you are in that situation? You believe God doesn't exist. Well, you have maybe when you die some regrets that you haven't had enough fun. And then Pascal the mathematician, says, okay, let's calculate the expected value. At that time, there was already the concept of expected value, probability theory. So he said, well, let's calculate what we can expect from believing. He combined probability with utility. That's exactly what decision theory does. And says, well, let's the probability of God existence is BP. P times what is the value of eternal salvation? That's infinity. Infinitely perpetual, forever. That's infinite. Our life on earth is very short, so you can describe this the losses that you have suffered as epsilon, minus epsilon, times the probability of 1 minus p. If you look at this mathematically, of course, it's infinity, because any finite value with infinity is always losing, dominated. If you don't believe, so you doubt, on the other hand, you get minus infinity dominating everything else, and you get minus infinity. So Pascal concluded the only rational thing is to believe. Again, I'm showing that just to show you, it explains how decision theory works. We have a decision, something under our control. There's something that we don't know, uncertain variables, and depending on the combination, our choices and the uncertainty, we get better or worse off, and there are consequences. In terms of the decision done by the scientist with this experiment of intercourse and pregnancy, here is a scientist's dilemma. The scientist observes data and then faces a decision. H0, typically that hypothesis denotes there's no effect. So intercourse does not cause pregnancy. They are completely independent of one another. H1 is intercourse causes pregnancy. But then you have the true state of nature, which you don't know. In science, you don't know it. We never learn the true states of nature. We talked about this, right? The philosophical problems of induction and determination. Did we talk about this last week? No? Oh, that's an important thing. As a scientist, it's very difficult not to get kind of brushed against philosophy of science. What is philosophy? It's a love of wisdom. Right? That comes from Greek. Philosophy of science is, of course, love of wisdom in terms of scientific procedure. whenever there is a new scientific procedure, a new set of experiments, new science emerges, you can be sure that philosophers of science will start studying it. So there are philosophers of science studying, for example, psychoanalysis of Freud, looking at the methodology. Could Freud have made the conclusions, drawn the conclusions that he has? There's a new method in physics, quantum physics. Philosophers of science will look at it. And then philosophy of science is very interesting. You can be sure that every new science, every methodology will be looked at by them. But in terms of science in general, and that's what we are doing in this course, science, research methodology, research design, empirical methods to learn the world, that's exactly science with a capital S. Science wants to guide us in learning the world. So, philosophy of science has identified two fundamental, unsolvable problems in science. The first problem is the problem of determination. Essentially, the question is, how do you know that what you perceive white to be there, right, that slide is white, black and white, or black and blue, actually, and black, blue, and white, how do you know that it's really black, blue, and white? That problem is unsolvable because in looking at the world, we are using our senses. And our senses are absolutely imperfect. White for us is just a mixture of different wavelengths. Yes, black is another wavelength. Blue is another wavelength or set of wavelengths. So when we describe the world, when we look at it with our senses, we cannot be sure that the world is really what we see. Think about this. We are looking with something that is imperfect, something that we have. Makes the picture of the world that we create definitely very untrustworthy and imperfect. The second problem that is also fundamental, unsolvable, is the problem of induction. The problem can be best explained on an example. Each one of us has seen swans. Well, that's not a good example, because there are black swans. But maybe ravens. Ravens, kruti. Ravens are black in color, yes? Can you say, after observing 10,000 ravens that are black in color, that all ravens are black? No. You can't say that, because you have observed 10,000, maybe you observed 1,000,000 ravens, all of them were black so far, but a statement, all ravens are black, is very risky, because tomorrow you may see a red raven or white raven. White ravens must be happening because of the albino thing, the coloring, that may happen. So any statement about the world that you make, any belief in the world is tentative. You haven't seen everything, you cannot say anything. So in case of this hypothesis, you will never know for sure whether this hypothesis is true or not. You will not know. You can just make a decision. Okay, for all practical purposes, I declare, after seeing the data, that probably intercourse causes pregnancy. That's the best you can do. And tomorrow, when somebody shows evidence, an experiment, that no, it wasn't intercourse, it was something else, you will have to take off your hat and say, well, sorry, I was wrong. This is the nature of science. Very, very different than, for example, religion, where the truth is forever, right? Whatever the religion teaches you, if you believe it, by just believing in it, you believe that this is true. In science, everything is temporary, tentative, and you can never be sure about the world, things that you are observing with your senses and seeing. So now, coming back to our decision, we make a decision, but there is still uncertainty, irreducible. You cannot reduce this uncertainty that hypothesis H0 is true or H1 is true. As I said, H0 is that there is no relationship. So if you declare as a scientist, after seeing the data, that there is no relationship between pregnancy and intercourse, then you have still to deal with two possibilities. Yes, there is no relationship in reality, so you were truthful, you made a good decision, the declaration is correct. But it may happen that you are wrong, that indeed intercourse causes pregnancy, and then you are too conservative. Status quo, no relationship. We had suspicions, but we didn't know for sure, and you declare no relationship, and you accept it, then you are obstructing the progress of science, essentially. You are making a mistake. You are making something that is known as type 2 error. On the other hand, if you say, oh, I've seen this data, and I think that intercourse does cause pregnancy, again, two possibilities. If you are right, wonderful, there's a new result. You can tell the people, well, if you want to have children, if you want to become pregnant, have intercourse. Very practical piece of knowledge, of course. Just like a knowledge about smoking and lung cancer. If you want to be healthy, don't smoke. Very practical knowledge. On the other hand, you can make a mistake. Maybe there is no relationship, and then you are rejecting that status quo. You were too bold and daring. You are proposing something that in reality is not true. Well, you are essentially leading the science, the field of science astray. So also bad thing. That's error type 1 error. You are rejecting age 0 while it's true. And type 2. So every decision that we make under uncertainty, we have to bear the consequences. It can be wrong. Every decision, really, because there are so few things that we can be certain about in the world. So a scientist's decision is the decision under uncertainty, and the scientist can make a mistake, can make an error. And the scientist will not know it until somebody else comes back and says, well, look at that. Here's my experiment. It shows that you were wrong. Can happen. Can happen to everybody, every scientist. Even then, you may say, okay, I was wrong. This guy may be right, but still you are not sure, right? You will never be sure. So now suppose that we are the scientist who wants to make a decision, and what we would like to know is, we would like to know, as in this scheme, I would like to know the probability of hypothesis H0. I have seen the data, so time comes from left to right. I have seen the data, I'm making a decision. In making that decision, I would like to know the probability of that thing. It's almost like I can calculate the expected value if I know the probability. So the question now, what is that probability? It's the probability of H0 given the data that I have seen. If you work it out using Bayes' theorem, reverse the probability, then this is the theorem of total probability. You simplify, substitute H0, H1 you replace by 1 minus H0, you will get that formula. Please note that we have something that we can call alpha and beta. These are two parameters, and everything else is probability of H0, the probability that that hypothesis is true. And here, the Bayesian view of probability theory, subjective is Bayesian. Well, probability is a measure of belief. You can start with a certain belief in a hypothesis. But unfortunately, the view of classical statisticians is that, sorry, but we don't know what probability of H0 is. They throw up their hands. That's the English expression for załamać ręce, to throw up their hands in despair. I don't know. Yes? So I don't know the probability of H0. Of course, I don't know the probability of H1 either. Have no idea. So I cannot solve this problem. I cannot use that formula to derive the probability of hypothesis H0 after seeing the data. I don't know the prior. So classical statisticians will reject this natural, normal, very intuitive approach. That's what we would like to do. So what do? They do something, they are reversing the problem completely into something that is not only counterintuitive, but also sometimes you could say useless, because it doesn't answer the questions that you have. What you would like is the probability of the hypothesis. So I have certain probability of hypothesis. Let's say I don't know, 50-50. I conduct the experiment, I see the data, and I say, oh boy, that hypothesis is more likely than I thought. The probability is so and so. Once I have that probability, I can make a decision. What do I declare? Yes, do I declare that H0 is true or H1? Here they say, we cannot do that, so what do? They invented a procedure that was early 20th century, 1920s. British statistician Ronald Fisher, Sir Ronald Fisher, so he got nobility from the king for his work in statistics, he proposed to make a decision based on a measure of surprise. So if something is surprising, given my set of beliefs so far, or my assumptions, then my assumptions must have been wrong. Suppose we are looking at, we are testing a hypothesis, for example, men and women are the same height. Yes, so the height of women and men is the same. An interesting hypothesis. We know it's actually wrong. We know that women are a little bit shorter, but suppose we are testing this hypothesis. We take a sample of women and a sample of men, a sample that is representative. So we take them randomly and measure them, how high they are, how tall they are, and we display the height of let's say men in this picture. Here is the mean height of men. Well, maybe we can reduce that hypothesis to height of Polish men and women are the same. So the sample is of Polish men, Polish women, and this is the mean of the Polish men, whatever it is. Let's say it's 170 centimeters, the average. Now we assume, we make an assumption that the height of the two populations are the same. So women come from the same population. And by the way, this is the distribution from which we take the means of the population. Distribution of a mean is a normal distribution. Why is that? Well, mean is a sum of things. So sum of things is distributed normally. Remember that thing that I mentioned. So if I take a sample of 100 Polish men, measure them, add their heights, and divide by 100, I get the average mean average height of men. That mean of men will come from the following population. This is the population from which the mean is drawn. It is normal. We know it by central limit theorem. Now let's take the 100 women and measure their height and calculate the average. Where will this average fall? And this is, by the way, 95% of the area under the curve is somewhere there. And where will this population of women, the average of women, be? Suppose it's here, right? It can happen. It will almost never be the same. If you take 200 of people, whatever, whoever they are, measure their mean of their height, it's never going to be the same, right? You take 100 men, here it is, our mu zero. Take 100 women, even if they come from the same population, even if they are just as high, as tall as men, that mean is never going to be the same. Suppose it's here. It can be also here. And now the procedure of classical statistical test, hypothesis testing is the following. If that mean falls within a certain range around the first mean, then it's not very surprising to me. Because, look, if women come from the same population, there's no difference between them in terms of height from men, then I can expect it to be different than mu zero, but somewhere here. If it falls within that interval, 95% of the area under the curve, then it's not terribly surprising. You know, it's 95. But if it falls outside of that, if the probability of observing that value is, let's say, 1%, then that's a surprising result, yes? I assume they are the same, but I'm observing a different value that is really far from my mean. How far is it? Well, the probability of observing that mean here is 1% only. Wow, that's surprising, isn't it? If the outcome of an experiment is surprising enough, then we reject our initial hypothesis. This is how the hypothesis testing works. He actually explained it on a different example. He explained it in his paper, inventing a lady who claimed that you should always pour tea first and then milk. You know, the British drink tea with milk. You are Nigerian, right? That was under British rule at some point, wasn't it? How do you drink your tea? With milk, probably. With milk, yeah. I the same in India, that's the British influence. Anyway, they drink it with milk. Maybe the influence was from India, I don't know, actually. Because this is where the British learned the tea. Although the tea might have been imported from the Far East, from China. I don't know. Anyway, we drink tea without milk here. The influence is from where? Probably the land influence from Russia, from China through Russia, I would think so.
I think we have like different way to say tea compared to other countries.
Yes, like from Latin.
Herbal drink. I think that's what the herbata come from.
Yes.
Like, it was a medicine.
Herba is Latin for herb, right?
So I think it's different influence, actually. So
yes, and then some countries have the word chai. Cha. Cha is the Chinese word for tea. What is that in Nigerian? You have many languages, probably.
Yes, but we just call it tea because
tea.
It's not in Nigerian.
British influence, probably, again.
We call it
tea. Tea, okay. Might have come from the British. British call it tea, of course. Again, tea. Okay. Anyway, so this lady claimed that that you should always pour milk tea first and then milk, I believe. And if you do it the other way, the tea is disgusting. She can feel it. So then Fisher said, okay, why don't we test the lady? We ask her, we close her eyes, we gave her a number of cups to try. Some of the cups will be with milk first, some of them will be with tea first, and then let her taste each one of them and make a statement. Now, suppose that she knows really the difference in taste. Suppose, how many cups out of the 8 cups, for example, how many would you expect to be correctly guessed? She can make a mistake, of course, like every human. How many? When would you be surprised if you assume that she is bullshitting, she has no idea about the taste difference, what result would you expect to be acceptable with this hypothesis that she has no idea? What result would you have to see to say, oh boy, she really knows the difference? And then he calculates, I think, out of 8 cups, if she makes one mistake, that is still acceptable as there is something in her taste. She probably knows the difference. So you are looking for a surprise. You say, you give her you kind of doubt her. No, she doesn't know that difference. You test her and then say, oh boy, if she doesn't know the difference, making 0 mistakes or only one mistakes out of eight, that's a surprise, surprising thing. Yes? So that's the principle. And somebody asked Fisher, what would be a good measure of surprise? When would you be surprised? And he was smoking a pipe. I imagine that he was smoking a pipe, pulled the pipe out of his mouth and said, I think like 1 in 20 probability, that would surprise me. Yes? And that is, they say, the origin of this 5% threshold. If you are surprised more than 5%, so if the probability is lower than 5% of seeing the result that you are seeing, then you say, oh, there must be something. I'm rejecting this zero hypothesis that I had in advance. So that's pretty much the way that it works. So the original question posed last week and repeated today in the beginning, what decision should the scientist make? Well, there's no way of putting the prior, statisticians will say. So you calculate essentially the probability of seeing, whatever it was, 20 pregnancies versus 5 in the other group, under the assumption that there is no relationship between intercourse and pregnancy. Is this surprising? Well, the question is how likely is it under this assumption? If it's surprising, and I suspect it is surprising, that number, you say, okay, I have no choice but to declare that my H0 was false, intercourse causes pregnancy. I mentioned the errors. You can always make a mistake in declaring that you reject H0 or that you keep H0. And then, of course, the consequences. You have to deal with consequences because it depends on the domain. The 5% is good for psychology, for things that, it's nice to know that that humans do this or that, but what if you are dealing with something very, very serious, like in medicine? You have a hypothesis that that has serious implications on people. If medical doctors, very often in medical publications, they use much lower threshold. 1 in 100, I've seen that. Why? Well, because you want to be conservative. You don't change the status quo until you have overwhelming evidence. So 1% you will observe, that's a big surprise. When I'm really surprised in a big way, then I will accept the new medical procedure. Otherwise, I want to stay the way it was. So that's a way of dealing with these consequences. And as I said, the 0.05 is a tradition. You can specify it yourself. You have to specify it in advance, because if you calculate the probability P and then you decide, okay, should I make the threshold higher or lower, that's, of course, not a very nice procedure. Before the experiment, you set the threshold value, and then you observe the P, calculate the P from the data, and then you make a decision. When you write papers, when you publish, typically in our fields, like in engineering, 0.05 is really very acceptable. If you set that value to be 0.1, people will criticize you. If you set it to 0.01, 1%, people will not criticize you. People will, that's very nice that it was such a strong effect that you observed that small value. There's also beta. Beta occurred, as you remember, in this formula. I derived the alpha and beta. Beta is another parameter, but very rarely used in science. Very, very few people use it. It's the probability of rejecting H0 when we should reject it. That's 1 minus beta. People don't use it, but it's a good idea to actually report variance, sample size, effect size, alpha, beta, in making this decision. By the way, in calculating the probability P of observing the value, typically what is important is the sample size, how many individuals I have in my experiment. What is the effect size? Effect size is essentially the difference. So it's the difference between 20 pregnancies and 5 pregnancies. That's quite a large difference, effect size. The difference can be very small. In medicine, there is they recommend people who have a risk of heart problems to take aspirin in the morning a smaller dose of aspirin. I remember reading that recommendation is based on the fact that in a huge population of 100,000 people, they observed 64,000 heart problems among people who did not take aspirin, and 63,520, I'm inventing those numbers, among people who took the aspirin. So very small effect size, of course, translating into hundreds of people in the population of 100,000. But actually, the effect size was very small. But it was statistically significant in the sense of surprising. Why the difference? As a scientist, you have to be very careful about one thing. Sometimes people take a data set and they start looking at different aspects of the data set. For example, testing, in this case, this is a joke. They test different hypotheses, too small of a letter. You can watch it at home. Purple jelly beans, link between purple jelly beans and acne, acne trądzik in Polish. Probability is bigger than 0.05. Brown jelly beans, bigger. Pink jelly beans, bigger. And so many, many, many tests that failed. And then suddenly they noticed, oh boy, there is well, it's actually a joke that is more complicated. But one of the tests comes out with p-value bigger than alpha, 0.05. They declared that this hypothesis is rejected, the H0. You have to be very careful because when you conduct many tests, suppose you have a data set on which you are conducting 100 different t-tests, classical tests, with alpha value, alpha threshold being 0.05. You can expect 5 hypotheses to be rejected wrongly. Even if the hypothesis H0 is true, 5% of the time it will be rejected, because there's 5% of the time, 5% probability that the result is going to fall in that region that is a surprise. So it's absolutely not correct to perform many tests, because some of them will come out, will suggest you to reject H0 just by chance. If you conduct 1, 2, 3 tests, it's okay, but for a bigger number of tests, you have to lower the threshold value, for example. You make it lower so that you make the probability of accidentally, wrongly rejecting H0 much lower. It's a typical novice mistake in this. Now, this was really a very brief review of statistics. And the important thing, the decision, statistical decision, we had to do it because as a scientist you will always have to use a statistical test to support your decision. You cannot just say, oh, it looks like I should reject this. You need to support it with numbers. That is what reviewers will expect from you, the significance level. And which test to use? Well, you need to look at the assumptions, every test. There are several tests, statistical tests. You need to look at the assumptions, whether they are fulfilled, and choose one. For comparing means, we use z-test. That is assuming that the distribution of the mean is normal. If there are too few data points, then the normality is slightly violated. And then you use student t-test, for example. ANOVA is yet another test, and there are other tests also. So which one do you use? You use the one that is justified by the assumption. Scientific method is more of a philosophical outlook than a single fixed procedure. I'm going to try in this course to give you the common sense, the main ideas here. You have to keep in mind that there is discipline-dependent language in the way you write, the way you describe your experiments, your results. And it's also, I found it in one of the textbooks, the advice, think Yiddish and write British. Yiddish language, the language of European Jews, probably Eastern European Jews, is a combination of German, Hebrew, and Slavic influences. And it's a language that is known for being very rich in words. There are words for all kinds of situations. For example, there is a word for a man, the feeling that a man feels seeing his children and grandchildren. I forgot what that word is, but I asked actually a Jewish person who knew Yiddish. There's a word for that. Feeling, proud feeling of a man who looks at the children and grandchildren and descendants. So very rich in words, the language. Use whatever works. Use the common sense. Most of all, your common sense when doing research, when doing experiments. When you describe them, write British. So very strict, very formal, very, you know, beautiful, strict language. Maybe less rich, but language is accepted by the field. Very often there are hidden assumptions in experiments, you have to be, you don't have to be explicit about things like determinism, indeterminism, but it's a good idea to actually remember about the assumptions. Next week, we will start today, but we will not finish. Next week, we'll talk about causality, the role of causality in experimental design. And you will notice that causal graphs will help you with making many of the assumptions very explicit. That's very important, actually, be explicit in the assumptions. Explanatory act, so the results that you produce, in order to be influential, must make sense. It's just a historical observation. When you make a claim that doesn't make sense, it's difficult to push it through the reviewers, to the readers, to publish it. So it must make sense. If something doesn't make sense, the burden of proof is on you. You have to prove it. I remember an anecdote, a real thing that happened to me. I took a course from a philosopher of science, Adolf Grünbaum. He died already. I mentioned him in this course for first year students. You may remember. I took a course from him, philosophy and religion. He focused on, in his final years of his activity as a philosopher, on philosophical scrutiny on claims made by religion. Hopeless task, you could say, because they are so different, religion and science, but he thought that he could still do it, and he had a lot of interesting observations, a criticism of religious claims. He focused on many things like miracles, and so I'm definitely going to mention Grünbaum in the context of scientific empirical work. But there was once in that seminar, there was a situation where he said, a small group, 10 people maybe, I was one asking a lot of questions because I'm religious, and he was a fighting atheist. Sometimes I would disagree with his anecdotal things. Like he would say, okay, you know, my colleague here in the department, he went to a Catholic school, and every time a child asked a question, the child was called to the director, to the principal, who was a priest. I told him, well, wait a minute, I went to schools, I had Catholic teachers, I've never had situations like this, right? So we disagreed on those anecdotal things. But one day, there was an interaction where I had to take my hat off. He was right. He said, those Catholics, they believe that when you lose something, I lose my glasses, for example, and you pray to St. Anthony, you will find it. I didn't know it, by the way, at that time, but I verified that with my aunt and then later with other people, that it's indeed true that the Catholics believe that. St. Anthony is one of the patrons of lost things.
My parents would like always repeat that, so it's
and it works for them.
Yeah. I was named after him, so...
Oh, of course.
So that's why they always like bring his name whenever something is lost. So that's, in my family, it's very like strong tradition.
And they believe it works. You know, I actually, after that, years after that, I did pray to St. Anthony in difficult situations when I lost something. It worked too. Again, okay, you can explain it differently. I'm also a scientist, so I'm skeptical. But look at the following situation. I'm going on a trip to Norway with my son. He's flying from US. I have two pieces of luggage, a big backpack and a small backpack with the important things, like not my passport. My passport was on my belt, on my belly, but I had maps, I had a water filter, and my hat, important things, really, the things that I really want to have handy. On the plane, there is a big excursion of kids going by train from Białystok to Warsaw. And they are getting off the plane in Warsaw East. And I'm very always helpful. I'm watching them, and the people who are taking care of them, they were in their 20s, early 20s, they are taking all the luggage of the children, taking them off the train. And I notice they are picking my big backpack. So I said, oh, wait a minute, this is mine, don't take it. Then I kind of got off, got my backpack from them, put them on the seat next to me. The whole cart was almost empty. I put my small backpack next to it. And then I was very helpful. So I helped them. I helped them with the luggage, helped them to get out of the plane. They didn't have enough time. Then they got off. We are going to the central station. On the plane, I realize, where is my small backpack? They must have taken it by accident. They thought it was a child's backpack. I'm in a panic because my plane, I'm going to the airport. Luckily, I was spending the night in Warsaw because the plane was leaving early in the morning. So what do? I call my wife immediately so that she calls the lost and found in Warsaw East. I'm starting to pray to St. Anthony, my wife also. I'm taking the next train back from Warsaw Central to the east. I'm going to that platform where they got off, I'm looking, and they are not there. Where are they? They could have gone to Gdańsk, for all I know, with my backpack, with everything. I ask somebody, like a railroad police, have they seen those people? They say, oh yeah, we saw them. They were in this tunnel, they were singing, but then they went somewhere. I don't know where. So I get to the railway station. I'm looking. I'm nowhere to be seen, those people. I'm desperate. What do I do? And then I see a young person who looks like one of the people taking care of them. Maybe there were two of them. And I ask, are you by any chance from that group of kids? And they said, because I lost backpack, you might have taken my backpack. And they said, yes, we've been looking for the person whose backpack it is. They were also desperate. They didn't know what to do because they took somebody's backpack. That person might have gone to Wrocław. The train was going further. So I had situations like this they looked hopeless, and they worked. Again, you can explain it in a variety of ways. Don't think I'm imposing on you my beliefs here. But in any case, Grunbaum says, Catholics believe that if you pray to St. Anthony, then St. Anthony will help you to find things. And then he says, where is a controlled experiment that proves this? So, of course, me always disagreeing with him, or often disagreeing with him. I liked him a lot. He was a great man. I value him. He was a great teacher. But I just scientifically disagreed with him often. So I said, well, wait a minute. Not everything that has never been tested is false, which is true. There are so many things that were never tested formally, like the following thing. If I come to you and hit you, you will probably hit me back. I didn't test it formally in an experiment, but I still believe it's true. It's probably true. Right? And you are bigger, you can probably beat me up, yes? There are many things like that we don't need to test because we just believe them. I mean, not only believe them, we have our experience to testify that this is the way the world works. So I told him that, and Grunbaum was a great thinker. He wasn't very fast. He wasn't very fast in that verbal ping pong that you know the politicians are doing. So I went to him during the break and told him, Dr. Grunbaum, this is what I meant, that there are many things that are true, but we never tested them. And then he said to me, yes, but look, this table here is not standing because of the legs that it has, but it's because there are four elves holding it. He demonstrated something very important in science. Something very, very important that you need to remember. If you are making an outrageous claim, and outrageous can mean a claim that other people don't believe. I bet you don't. Are you Christian? Or, oh, you're Christian, no? You may actually, did you know about St. Anthony? Or you may be a different denomination?
Different denomination.
Okay. Protestants. Protestants don't believe in saints at all, right? So, okay. You don't believe it. So, you see, if I make that claim, in a company of people who are not Catholics, you will look at me and say, well, wow. You will start smiling, of course, and that's understandable. Now, what does a scientist have to take into account? If you make an outrageous claim, outrageous for the audience, of course, then the burden of proof is on you. So if I make that claim to you and, you know, other Protestants or people of different denomination, then I'd better prove it. I have to show you the results of an experiment. If I don't show you the results of an experiment, I tell you a story like I just told you, that's not enough, right? It's not enough to convince you, because you can easily find a rational explanation. Those kids were going only to Warsaw, not to Gdańsk, right? And whatever, right? I came across them in the railway station because they were looking for me. And this was an obvious place to be, to look for somebody. Anyway, important principle. If you make an outrageous claim, you'd better prove it. In science, if you are making a claim that is flying in the face of what people have believed so far, you'd better prove it. You invent a new type of concrete. You have a new soil component. That people, you find out that throwing tea leaves, use tea leaves in that makes it absolutely, you know, the plants are growing like crazy. People at first will not believe you. You have to show the results of an experiment. Very important principle that in explanatory fact, to be influential, must make sense. If it doesn't make sense, you'd better provide strong evidence for it. I think we are out of time, but we are also out of the slides, so actually perfect ending. I'm sometimes telling you juicy stories. This is not a waste of time. They are illustrating certain principles, so be patient with me. I'm not just presenting you the dry things, but also telling you things that are important. So next week we will start with causality. I'll tell you the theory. I'll show you many examples. I think we'll take the whole 1.5 hour to talk about causality. After that, we'll talk about different architectures of experiments. So how does a scientist design experiments? What are the architectures that we know? How can we explain them in causal terms? Okay? So good. Thank you very much, and see you next week. Next week, I think.